Welcome to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. In the 1951 convention relating to the status of refugees, a policy was enshrined to forbid the removal of asylum seekers to countries where they are likely to be tortured or killed. The U.S. signed on, at least in part, to atone for rejecting a boat carrying 900 Jewish escapees from Nazi Germany in 1939. At least 200 were later killed in the Holocaust. When President Trump began his campaign, he made anxieties about whiteness under siege a signature part of his platform, and he promised to, quote, deport all criminal aliens and save American lives. Since his inauguration, the number of refugees being returned to dangerous countries has increased. Sarah Stillman has been documenting the results, and you can read about them in her recent story for The New Yorker, When Deportation is a Death Sentence. Sarah Stillman, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's go back to the beginning. What was the concept of, was the concept of the refugee born?
Well, it really emerged out of the post-World War II context. So I think you said it quite well in your introduction that in 1951, the United Nations enshrined this notion of the refugee in the Refugee Convention and essentially laid out the terms. So anyone who had a well-founded fear of being persecuted in their home country for reasons of race, religion, nationality, and a number of other potential factors should be protected. And essentially that meant that the signatories to the convention would say that they would never send someone knowingly back to a situation where they could be killed or a situation where they could be tortured or deprived of their freedom. I think you're absolutely right that it was an act of atonement. I think the U.S. had certainly recognized their failures in the midst of the war. It wasn't just the single boat of 900-some Jewish escapees from Nazi Germany. There was also many thousands, including, I learned in the research for the story, Anne Frank, whose family had actually applied for Anne and her sister to be refugees in the U.S. and who were rejected and who were perceived really as national security threats. So a lot of the rhetoric from that era feels quite familiar in our current, in the context of a refugee crisis that actually has superseded that of post-World War II.
Well, speaking of post-World War II, I'm wondering how much of a shadow has this history cast over America's approach to refugees? Clearly, the answer is yes, but does it hang even heavier now?
I think in some ways the metaphor is really resonant, the idea that, you know, people that were previously considered potential threats later in retrospect seemed like people who were deserving of protection. So I think we did actually enshrine, both domestically and then also in the concept of international law, the idea that we would never make that same mistake again. But of course, what we're seeing at the moment is many, many families fleeing gang violence in Central America, people coming here really genuinely fearing for their lives and being pretty consistently turned away either at the border or domestically in the context of our immigration courts and being sent back to harm. So it was really the concept of the piece I embarked on with a team of reporting fellows at Columbia University at the journalism school was basically to document how frequently people are being turned away and, in fact, are not only facing hypothetical threats when they get back, but are indeed, in cases we've documented, being killed or tortured or sexually assaulted or facing any number of other harms.
Right. And before we get into the specifics of those, let me ask you about overall, how does one prove that they have, and this is the language, a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion?
Right. It's a good question. I mean, it's a very robust process. And despite Trump's many arguments that our refugee vetting is lacking, we actually have one of the most rigorous processes in the world. And at the border, what it means is that Border Patrol is trained to ask that question to people. Do you fear for your lives if you returned? And then their job is not to actually adjudicate those claims, but in fact, to just pass someone along to a well-trained asylum officer or refugee officer who then goes through a pretty rigorous often a series of very lengthy interviews. And oftentimes, in many of the cases I I profiled in the piece, I spoke to families who did provide quite a great degree of documentation of their fear. So sometimes what that looks like is, you know, presenting the death certificates of siblings who have been killed by the gangs, or other forms of documentation showing that police reports domestically were in their home countries were ignored, things of that nature. But of course, that's not entirely easy, because many of these people, in the context of fleeing for their lives, have left almost everything behind, mm-hmm. and are also leaving countries where the rule of law is not very strong, so they may not have, they may have feared actually going to police. In the cases I looked at from Central America, right. around 10% of the people had actually cited their fear of police or actually direct persecution from law enforcement as one of their reasons for fleeing.
So Sarah, what specifically has changed in American immigration policy such that a person with a credible fear of persecution could be expelled, and this again is another term of art here, in any manner whatsoever to a territory where he or she fears threats to life or freedom?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think some of it is specific to the Trump era and some of it has been going on for quite some time. So the stuff that's specific to the Trump era, I would argue, is the empowerment of many, both Border Patrol officers and Customs and Border Protection officers who are working at ports of entry, feeling increasingly empowered in some cases to simply turn people away, feeling like they have the thumbs up of the president. And I would argue those cases tend to be direct violations of domestic law. But I've spoken to many people who documented cases at ports of entry where people didn't even try to come here unauthorized. They, in fact, presented themselves directly at a port of entry, presented their documentation of why they fled for their lives, and were, in fact, simply told by officers, you know, sorry, have you not heard who's president now? We're not taking asylum seekers anymore, which, of course, is not
not true.
Not correct. But nonetheless, is sending people back. And in fact, some of those people, I've spoken to lawyers who've documented cases where some of those people have almost immediately been kidnapped by drug cartels right across the border in Mexico, where there are a number of people who prey upon that population.
So, and then other things
we're seeing that are quite longstanding. So, you know, we changed the law back under Bill Clinton in that people, certain people could be subject to very, very rapid removal. So it's a process known as expedited removal, and people who are found at the border can be quite quickly returned without the conventional access to due process, without ever seeing a judge.
Mm-hmm. So, Sarah, let me take you back to that comment you made just a second ago about asylum seekers being told by federal officials, don't you know who the president is now? We're not taking these requests. That sort of speaks to the fear, I think, of a lot of people, and probably shocks a lot of people, at just how arbitrary it seems these laws are implemented or not implemented.
Right. I think that's a really good word for it, arbitrary. You see that both at the border in the examples we just discussed, and then you also see it in the immigration courts. I mean, as we talked about with the Refugee Convention having come out of the World War II context, one of the things that's quite complicated about that is that in the current threats that people are fleeing, those are quite different from what were the threats that people were fleeing during World War II. And it means that oftentimes the outcomes in asylum courts are incredibly arbitrary. So I looked at the geographic disparities, for instance, that people have documented. If you present the exact same case fearing for your life in a New York court versus a case that you present in Atlanta, Georgia, your odds may be wildly different. So maybe 80% versus 5% of receiving the protection that you've requested. So there are many different things that make a kind of roulette wheel for people who are genuinely seeking asylum.
So why, Sarah, did you decide to create a record of people who had been deported to harm?
Well, what's interesting to remember for me, tracing back to the origins of the project, it actually began prior to the Trump presidency. So this was in the midst of many, many families fleeing Central America and showing up at the border. And I felt that it was constantly invoked in the political debate in Washington that people could potentially be deported to their deaths. But very rarely did we see actual documentation of that, partly because it turns out to be very hard to document. There's some scholars who've looked at it and done a lot of work on it, but it turns out many of the families of the harmed parties are very, very afraid to speak out. And of course, the U.S. government has neither the interest nor resources in tracking deportees who are killed. So the theory was, you know, what would it look like to actually chase down that hypothetical and see how frequently this really is happening? And I'm sure, even though my team at Columbia Journalism School and I documented upwards of 60 cases of harm, including deaths, I'm sure we only began to scratch the surface of the number of cases that are actually out there.
And Sarah, talk specifically about how you were able to document these cases, because you just said a second ago that basically there's no clearinghouse for all this information. Didn't you and your team, you were very crafty and inventive and innovative in how you went about this.
Yeah, well, I've always really envied people who went to law school and got to partake in a law school clinic, so that the clinical legal education model is, you know, a team of 17 people or 18 people working diligently on a case, and I thought it'd be interesting to transport that to the journalism school context. And so we basically divided the country and, to some extent, the region, and had each student calling you know, 5 or 10 different local legal aid organizations, immigrant rights groups, people who might have come across these cases. And so we tried to canvass the country and then speak to people in the region, people running migrant shelters, domestic violence shelters, all kinds of legal aid organizations. And then we just slowly, piece by piece, started patching together cases where we might have leads and began traveling the country every time we found a family who had the courage to share their story. And in that respect, actually, Trump's election helped people's openness, because I think many people at this point who are undocumented feel such a profound sense of instability and such a profound sense of fear and many of these families have lost the worst thing they could possibly imagine losing, a loved one. And so they felt like it was time to speak up.
That's interesting. So despite the fear and uncertainty, especially in this age of Trump, people who you have reached out to talk to, they, despite the fear, are willing to talk to you, willing to get their stories out.
Yeah, I'm always so fascinated by that human instinct. People want to be heard, and people want to share. And most of all, what people said again and again, the family members of people who have been killed after their deportations, they said, I want to share this story because I really hope that it can help prevent this from happening to other people, even though I'm terrified. But I should say the fear also works in reverse. So one of the things we documented in the story was how profoundly immigration fears have affected people's reporting of domestic violence and sexual assault, and how many undocumented women have feared coming forward about gender-based violence claims. And so we actually spoke to some law enforcement and prosecutors around the country who said that they actually fear that immigration anxieties are harming public safety efforts, as opposed to Trump's rhetoric of enhancing public safety, that it makes people more reticent to come forward about crimes in communities where there's large numbers of undocumented families.
Right, driving them underground. Before we go to a break, I have to ask you direct the Global Migration Project. Where is that, and what does that work involve?
Right, so I direct the Global Migration Project. It's based out of Columbia Journalism School, and it's been a real gift so far, because it's basically meant having a wonderful team of diligent postgraduate fellows and teaching a class on gender and migration. And we really tend to focus our stories on the intersection of immigration issues, migration refugee issues domestically and abroad, and also on issues of gender. And so one of the things that we have found in the context of asylum seekers' claims is that many, many, many of the people fleeing Central America have fled some kind of gender-based violence, whether it's gang members trying to extort sex or force women to be their, quote, girlfriends, so sexual assault, or people fleeing domestic violence.
Well, we are going to
we really tried to document that,
right,
that facet of the immigration story.
And we're going to talk specifics about some of the cases that you learned and that you report about in The New Yorker when we come back from this break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Sarah Stillman, New Yorker staff writer, about her story, When Deportation is a Death Sentence. Later on in the show, Richard Jenkins, who stars in Guillermo del Toro's film The Shape of Water. Plus, Reeves Wideman investigates why the family that pioneered the oil industry in America wants to expose what Exxon hid from the public about climate change. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. We're back on Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I've been speaking with Sarah Stillman, New Yorker staff writer, about her latest piece, When Deportation is a Death Sentence. Sarah, let's get into specific cases, and let's start where your story starts, and that's with the story of Laura S., who on June 9th, 2009, just after 2 a.m., was pulled over. What happened after that?
Right. So Laura was a young mother who had been living in Texas her entire adult life. She had U.S. citizen children. She was driving home from work one night at the restaurant where she was employed. And she was pulled over for a minor traffic violation. So driving between two lanes was the allegation. And for whatever reason, the cop did something that was at the time pretty unconventional, but it's becoming increasingly common under President Trump and under some state laws that have been passed, which is that the officer decided to ask her about her immigration status. And then he asked everyone else in the car about their immigration status. And when he learned that a number of them in the car, including Laura, were not documented, he decided to call Border Patrol to the scene. And at this point, Laura begins to cry and begins to very clearly tell him that she was terrified because she had a ex-husband who had been deported, who was living across the border in Reynosa, Mexico, a very dangerous part of Mexico, and he had been routinely threatening to kill her. And nonetheless, Border Patrol comes to the scene. She repeats her pleas. She's crying. And that very same night, a few hours later, she was actually sent back across the bridge after having been allegedly coerced into signing the paperwork to be deported that night. And her last words to the Border Patrol agent were, "When I'm found dead next week, it's going to be on your conscience." And in fact, that's exactly what happened. She was killed by the very man that she believed would kill her and who had been threatening to kill her. And her body was found incinerated in her car.
Now, you gave a great thumbnail of that story because you weave all of that in your story in The New Yorker. One thing that listeners should know is that all the other women in the car were also trying to help Laura by telling the police officers, or maybe it was Laura herself, I can't remember, where she's saying, "Look, I will show you emails. I will prove to you what I'm telling you about the danger that I face."
Exactly. Oh, she was absolutely unequivocal, as were her friends. She was very clear. She had a previous emergency protective order against this guy. She had very credible reasons to fear that he would, in fact, kill her. He was involved in a drug cartel in Reynosa. And so it was totally and utterly clear, both to the police officer and then later to the Border Patrol, that this woman was someone who very much feared for her life and who ought to have, at the very least, been granted a chance before an immigration judge.
Can we talk about, Sarah, Nazario Solis III? He was the police officer who pulled Laura and her friends over. Talk a little bit more about him.
Right. So he's no longer on the police force because he was later found to be involved in drug conspiracy and a number of other criminal conspiracies as a police officer. But his choice at the time, as I mentioned, was unconventional, but increasingly in Texas, the debate around legislation known as SB4 has actually meant that police are now supposed to be required to inquire about immigration status and to turn people over to Border Patrol. And similarly, there's a requirement known as kind of the fight against sanctuary cities, whereby, you know, if someone is in local detention, they're supposed to be turned over to Border Patrol or to ICE and to immigration authorities if they're found to be undocumented. And so that is becoming, in fact, pretty routine around the country, even though many of the local border cops I've spoken to say that this just puts an enormous burden on them when right. What they're really trying to do is enforce public safety locally.
Laura had children. What happened to her children?
Oh, gosh. I mean, her children have been on a real journey. And as you can imagine, losing your mom in such a violent circumstance is not something that a child ever gets over. So
were they I'm sorry, Sarah. Were they with her or were they still back in the States?
Well, at some point, so Laura gets sent back,
right.
And because her whole family knows that she fears for her life, they immediately start to try to figure out how they're going to rescue her, try to figure out how they will get her quickly back across the border to her kids in Texas. And so what that entails is her mother driving the two kids, because they couldn't leave the kids by themselves, she drives the two kids back to Reynosa, and they begin quickly working on a rescue plan. But that was going to entail digging up some money to help get her back across, and that was not something they could come up with quickly enough. So one of the children was actually present when shortly after, I believe maybe a day or two after Laura was deported, the man who ultimately killed her first chased her down and rammed his car into her vehicle, and one of the children was there crying and watching the whole scene unfold as Sergio, the ex-husband, tried to kill Laura.
Right.
But she escaped in that instance, and then a few days later could not escape.
You're listening to Sarah Stillman, New Yorker staff writer, talking about her latest piece, When Deportation is a Death Sentence. Sarah, let's talk about Ana Lopez. You write about Ana Lopez, and she's the mother of a 20-year-old gay asylum seeker named Nelson Avila Lopez, who wrote a letter to the U.S. government during Christmas week of 2011, 2 months after Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or otherwise known as ICE, accidentally deported him to Honduras. What happened to Nelson when he returned home?
Right. Well, Nelson's case is a really good example of what happens when you try to do immigration enforcement very, very quickly. I think it sometimes leads to sloppiness, and Nelson's case is an example of the stakes of that. So Nelson had actually fled Honduras at age 17. He was an unaccompanied minor. He tried to get to his mother in California, and he was pretty quickly put in removal proceedings. And it turned out tricked by a lawyer into giving over a good bit of money to try to make his case, and then he was never alerted to the proper court dates and was ordered to be deported. And ultimately, when he was apprehended, his family got a better lawyer. They quickly applied for asylum, and a judge said, "You cannot deport this young man until he has a chance to seek asylum." Instead, that I believe it was the very next day or very quickly thereafter, ICE accidentally put him on a plane, sent him back to Honduras, claiming that they had not been notified about the stay, about the order that he not be deported. And his mother at that point, as you mentioned, made this plea to the U.S. government, "Please, you have to get my son back. He's going to be killed." And in fact, he had been pretty swiftly detained in Honduras and not given any clear charges, according to the lawyers, and was killed in a prison fire that killed upwards of 350 people. And it was believed to potentially have been gang-related, the fire.
He was detained in Honduras, and no charges were filed.
Right. This part's a bit of a mystery, but one of the things that has happened in Honduras is that with the massive crackdown on the gangs, you've seen it sometimes go so far in the direction of aggressive detention that it has meant even if someone has tattoos, which in some cases have been forced upon young people. I mentioned Nelson, for instance, was not only a gay asylum seeker, but also someone who had been coerced by the gangs in the past and threatened with his life if he didn't join. He was in a situation where, like many, many other young men in Honduras, he was essentially immediately rounded up when he arrived at the airport on the flight, deporting him home.
Let's talk about Juan Carlos Coronilla Guerrero. And what happened with him, I believe, was a traffic violation or a workplace dispute. What was his case?
So this is one of the cases that has unfolded in the Trump era, and it's a direct result of what we were speaking about a moment ago regarding the crackdown on sanctuary cities. So Juan Coronilla Guerrero, he was someone who had come from Mexico as a teenager. He'd been deported, and then he came back. And he was working as a carpenter. He had three kids, and someone had reported him in the neighborhood for a domestic dispute. And police had found him in possession of, I believe it was something like a quarter of a gram of marijuana. So these were misdemeanor offenses. And typically you would show up in the county courthouse, go to your misdemeanor hearing, and that would be that, and the crime would be dealt with accordingly. But in his case, because he was in Travis County, Texas, where the sheriff had recently announced that she was going to be a sanctuary city and was not going to honor ICE requests for turning people over who they found undocumented to immigration authorities. What that meant was that it appears ICE retaliated on that particular county, and it just so happened for Juan's case that at that very moment that he was showing up in court, ICE was actually showing up inside of the courthouses, which was very unconventional. It was not a place where they were conventionally welcome. And what they did is immediately detained and arrested Cormier directly after his hearing and put him into removal proceedings. So essentially lined him up to be deported. And it was a pretty similar case to the ones we just discussed, in that his family members, his wife, begged a federal judge saying, "I believe that he will be killed if he's sent back." And in fact, he was deported in June, and a few months later, he was killed. He was actually awoken from his bed, where, according to the Austin American Statesman, he was actually trying to comfort his child, saying, "Don't worry, my love, everything will be okay," essentially. And then he was taken outside and shot to death.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times that in the two or maybe all three of the cases that we were talking about, where family members have written letters to judges or other people have been pleading with law enforcement to help. And these are among the patterns that you started seeing when you started investigating these, what happens to people who have been deported from the United States. What other patterns did you see emerging once your investigation got underway?
Well, one of the interesting things we found is that Trump has continuously purported to prioritize people he calls bad hombres, so people with criminal convictions or serious felonies. And in fact, what we're seeing is that many of the people rounded up are people like Laura, so people who had done minor traffic offenses. In some cases, these are people who actually just came forward to the government affirmatively to declare themselves and try to seek some kind of legal avenue to remain in the country. We're also seeing that people really underestimate, in some cases, the urgency of the DACA debate. Because one of the things about Laura's case is that her cousin, who was in the car that night and who watched everything unfold, she was the only person who didn't get deported that night because she was here legally and had ultimately obtained DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, as someone who had lived in the country for quite some time since she was a young person. And now, since Trump's election, she has actually lost her status, and she now fears for her own life because she's been getting death threats for having testified in the murder trial in Laura's case. So that's another example of one of the patterns we found, is that many of the people now fearing for their lives are people who have committed no crimes and who have pretty deep roots in the country.
Does any U.S. government body monitor the fate of those who are deported?
No, I think there's not really much incentive for the U.S. government to try to understand the patterns of what happened to people post-deportation. There are some really superb human rights organizations, such as Human Rights Watch, Clara Long, and some others there have documented what happens to people post-deportation. There are some fantastic scholars like Elizabeth Kennedy who have worked to document this issue. But really, it takes a tremendous amount of resources. And again, we only begin to scratch the surface when we try to look for these cases, because you really cannot underestimate the degree of really credible fear that people have about speaking out, certainly when they're back in their home countries as
right.
well.
Right. Let me ask you about the field manual for agents that you were able to get your hands on, or at least have access to. And this is the field manual is what agents use when they interview asylum seekers. And there's a series of questions that the agents must ask an unauthorized immigrant before subjecting him or her to immediate deportation. One of them is, do you have any fear or concern about being returned to your home country or being removed from the United States? Are the agents tasked with evaluating the validity of the fear expressed?
And no, in fact, that is very clearly not their job. So their job is to essentially serve as a screen, both to find people who may have come unauthorized, but then to also potentially protect them or usher them in the right direction if they do express fear. So they have to ask these questions: do you fear for your life if you're returned? And then if someone says yes, it's not their job to dig into that claim further. Their job is simply to pass someone along to a very well-trained person known as an asylum officer, and that person is then going to engage in a lengthy interview, and then ultimately the asylum seeker may wind up before an immigration judge to really have their case heard. But too often we're seeing that that's not happening. So many groups, including the ACLU, have documented how asylum seekers have been in many cases, upwards of 50% not even asked the appropriate questions that they're required to be asked. And then even if they are asked, sometimes these women or individuals express their fear and are nonetheless rejected and immediately deported.
Right.
Despite clear legal requirements to pass them along.
Right. Let's talk about, in the remaining minutes that we have left, let's talk about Rosaleda in Queens, who worked as a police officer in Honduras until her investigation of a cousin's murder revealed a high-ranking colleague's involvement in the crime, which she reported to the department. What happened after that?
Exactly. She started facing pretty troubling situations after she reported her colleague for the murder, and she started facing death threats. She faced a few assassination attempts where people left notes saying, "We will kill you the next time." She tried to switch her post, and her supervisor told her that she could only switch if she would allow him to have sex with her regularly. So ultimately, she decided she just had to flee, like so many other women from that part of Honduras. And she gets to Texas, and it's not entirely clear whether Border Patrol asked the right questions. One reason this case is really illuminating is it shows oftentimes people are just scared. They're coming from situations where the rule of law was not strong, and where in Rosalita's case, she had very good reason to distrust police and authorities. And so she was swiftly deported and immediately faced persecution again. And when she fled back to the U.S., she was kidnapped by a drug cartel and held for ransom. But we interviewed other women who very clearly expressed their fear to Border Patrol and who were nonetheless on the paperwork seeing claims that they had not, in fact, said that they feared for their lives, and who were then sent back and sexually assaulted.
That's common, isn't it, that a person gets to Border Patrol, clearly expresses their fear, and Border Patrol does nothing with it or ignores them or sends them back?
Exactly. So I should say that many Border Patrol officers are very honorable in how they do their jobs. And some of them told me that this is a part of the job they actually perceive as very rewarding, because it really does strike directly at how many people conceptualize one of the proudest aspects of America, which is that we have been a land of refuge. We have been a land of providing safe haven. And so I shouldn't paint with a broad brush here. I think there are many Border Patrol agents who take this part of the job really seriously. But all too often, we've seen it quite well documented by the ACLU, by Human Rights Watch, by my own reporting with Colombia, that people are in fact getting sent back and facing pretty horrible stakes as a result.
Now, you mentioned that Rosaleda, she made her way back across the border again. She was kidnapped by a cartel. She was also held for ransom. But didn't she eventually make it to New York?
Exactly. So she did, and she actually found fantastic pro bono legal help, which is one of the amazing things about New York and a lot of the larger cities where some immigrants wind up, is that there are many organizations that pour a great amount of care into these kinds of cases. But the best they're able to win for her is the status known as withholding of removal. So it's actually not the same as asylum, because anyone who has been previously sent back no longer qualifies for asylum. And this was a predicament that a lot of the women we spoke to were in, which was essentially that you could argue that they were illegally deported in the first place. And then as a result of that illegal harm that was done to them, and as a result of the fact that they fled again because they credibly feared for their lives, they're no longer eligible for asylum due to that prior deportation. So that's exactly Rosalita's circumstance.
Sarah, you've brought us tragic stories, but important stories for us to know. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I've been speaking with Sarah Stillman, New Yorker staff writer, and she's been talking about her reporting on the tragic consequences of deportation for some immigrants in the United States. Her story is When Deportation is a Death Sentence. Sarah, again, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for your time and for your care on this issue.
Thank you. Coming up, Richard Jenkins, who stars in Guillermo del Toro's film The Shape of Water. And later, historian Neil Ferguson joins us to discuss his new book, The Square and the Tower, Networks and Power, From the Freemasons to Facebook. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break.